Yes, 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 world. That about concludes another episode of Crimes and Treasons Radio. Mr. Solo Dolo, part two in the building. Yours truly, Jamal Steeles. Had to mix it up tonight, man. We had to end with an oldie but goodie, Maeda and Buddy. Before that, we had Toronto's very own, the Mel Flower. Of course, ladies be running shit, so we had to put a little Coil Array in there featuring Busta Rhymes, Luxury Life. Also, big shout out to BB Borelli. For y'all wondering, yo, who was doing that Umi Says Most Def cover? Joey Badass. Yes, yes. Big shout out to everybody that fucks with us on the weekly. If this is your first time, be sure to join us again next Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the best station in the universe, CITR 101.9 FM. Big love to everybody checking us out on Twitch, twitch.tv/crimesandtreasons. Be sure to check us out and listen to past podcasts at crimesandtreasons.com. as well as CITR.ca. Be sure to keep it locked in. We got some great entertainment for y'all coming up next. The homeboy Issa Arian with Off the Beaten Path. Let's get it.
You're here with Crimes and Treasons Radio, Jazz Cartier. Y'all know who it is, Golden Child, baby. Let's get it.
What up? This is Machine Gun Kelly, and right now I am tuned in to Crimes and Treasons, goddammit.
Hey, yo, this is Isaiah Rashad.
Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy, Just Blaze.
Yo, 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 what's good? It's Bodega Bams, a.k.a. Poppy, a.k.a. Young Don Francisco.
Hey, yo, it's Baby No Money.
What's good, y'all? It's your boy, Terrell Safady.
Hey, what's up? It's Tion Kidd.
What up? This is Stango.
And this is your boy, Waldo.
And you're listening to Crimes and Treasons Radio.
Yeah, bitch.
What's up? This is Peanut Butter Wolf. You're listening to Crimes and Treasons Radio.
Hello, this is Blow Fly.
Hey, this is Halo.
Hey, what's up? It's St. John, and you're not listening to Crimes and Treasons. It's lit.
Hey, I know who it is, man. It's your boy, Saha the Prince.
Yo, what up, though? This is Ill Tone from Blacktivity.
Yo, peace, family. It's your Guala Dizzy Rice.
Yo, this is Remy Wolf.
Hey!
Yo, what's poppin', man? It's I Am Soup.
It's Jay Worthy, a.k.a. P Worthy.
Hey, yo, you already know what time it is. It's your boy, ASAP Yams, a.k.a. Yamborghini, a.k.a. Lil Newport, a.k.a. motherfucking... I got too many motherfucking aliases, but you already know what time it is. Crime and treason in this motherfucker. Shout out to these motherfuckers. They putting it down with that real trill shit.
Yo, 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 yo. It's Cam Blow Out.
Crimes and treasons. That's what we believe in while we blowing the treason.
Crooks out.
Tune in to Vancouver's rap radio show every Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Crimes and treason. Thank you.
Yo, ooh, wee, that's loud. You're welcome. Welcome, 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 welcome. I'm your host, East Arian A. And you're tuned in to Off the Beaten Path here on 101.9 CITR.ca. We do this every week, Tuesday, 10 to 11, right after Crimes and Treasons. Keep it locked in here on Tuesdays. We're broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam, Coast Salish, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish Nations territory. And we're here. What we do on the show every week is we talk about what's going on here in the Lower Mainland, what's going on here in Canada, what's going on here in North America, what's going on here, you know, in this the Northern Hemisphere, the Earth, the moon, the stars, the sun, the satellite, you know, just to keep it interesting so we can make sure that you feel informed as you're moving throughout your week. Not only are you informed in what's coming up, but you are also informed on who's coming up, what new music, what new artists, and what new things that you need to see, watch, hear to kind of stay with it. Honestly, this is probably one of my favorite parts of the year, particularly as it comes to here in Vancouver. There's so much stuff going on. You have such nice weather where it is not just you get this nice blue sunny sky with the sunshine, but you also we're also transitioning into the, I would say weird, but you know, the very predictable winter weather. I find that fall is a time not so much where people are sad and people are, you know, really feeling that kind of coldness from the winter, but it's, you know, just right as people move out of summer, people are moving on out of their summer flings, people are moving on out of their summer tings, people are just enjoying what the new transitions, what is it going to look like for them in the, you know, in the next few months. And it's, people are excited, like there's a lot of optimism in fall. Like I find that fall for me, it's a lot of optimism. It's probably because I spent a lot of my fall around Ohio football fans, Browns and Bengals fans, and what you know is that September is the only month that they ever feel good. And so as we get into this next few months, October, November, you'll see the optimism start to dwindle in people and the light slowly go out. But while it's here, we must enjoy it. We must enjoy just how it feels, what it looks like. And also, it's one of my favorite parts of the year as we move into Vancouver International Film Festival. So right this week, we are pretty much right smack in the middle. Vancouver International Film Festival started on the 29th last week, last Thursday, and kicked off with some great films, this great weekend. And it continues until October 8th. So if you haven't had a chance, please go check out some films. There's some great films that I have been fortunate enough to see and write reviews on. So if you don't want to do the hard work and trying to pick through the 180 films that are screening, you can just listen to the rest of the show. And on the show today, I'm going to be talking about some of the films that I've seen. I'm going to be sharing an interview that I did with Corey Payette, who is a director of the film. I'm going to be interviewing another few directors over the next few days and going to air those interviews intermittently as we continue to move on throughout the film festival. But if you have the chance, please go watch. A lot of people, one of the things that I love about these film festivals is you learn not just the, I think it's so easy to get caught up in what is, I would say, a movie versus a film. Like, what is a movie that we watch, you know, in a blockbuster on a weekly basis, a monthly basis? You know, we feel, we see, we hear the, you know, $100 million movies, $150 million movies. We hear the stories about, especially especially after we've been able to witness the writer's strike and the actor's strike and the animator strike that's going to be coming up. You know, we hear the stories about how studios are working people to the bone and not providing people with, you know, safe work environments, and how they are looking to exploit people at all, in all aspects. And I think that that's one of the things we can see about the movie business, which is ugly. And we can see, we constantly having that within our kind of cultural conversation. But I find that Vancouver International Film Festival and other film festivals around town, also around the different parts of the year, but particularly Vancouver International Film Festival, for me, allows me an opportunity to really kind of dive in and connect with the art and the artists that people are making. The art that people are making, it is incredible too. I haven't seen this film yet, but reading about this movie, Apollonia, I'm going to talk about the film that I've seen, but reading about this movie, Apollonia, and understanding that there's a documentarian who followed an artist around for 13 years, and this is the culmination of that woman's work. And so when I think about that type of movie and that type of documentary, it's not just simply about the artists who they are portraying, you know, who are they showcasing and putting together a film that goes over over a decade of someone's life, but what it took to create that, you know, what it took to put your life on hold as a director, as a filmmaker, and sit and find this to be worthy, you know, those moments when it didn't feel that way. I'm sure there was a ton of moments that way, or those moments when it felt like this is exactly what you should be doing, but the sacrifices that you've had to make, or, you know, the sacrifice that you've had to make, you know, the things you've missed in your own life, in your own family's life, and kind of what does that look like to put that together? And that's not something that you really get in these blockbuster movies. It's a feeling, right? It's a feeling. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of the movies that I have felt, but first I wanted to kind of share just some music, what's going on here in the Lower Mainland, talking about the weather. Listen, we talk about the weather here quite often because it's just something that, you know, all of us are experiencing. And if you're here, you understand that the weather's changing, but we have been lucky and fortunate enough to have our weekends maintained. One of the most frustrating things I find about this place is that always the weekends are the worst. Like, the weeks can be great and then the weekends will be the worst. But I'm finding that this year is a little bit different, or maybe it's something that I've just noticed over the last little bit. I don't know why I'm breathing so hard, to be honest. Like, I don't know if you can hear it, but I feel like, wow, I'm out of breath. And it's kind of, sometimes being out of breath is scary because you're like, I haven't done anything yet. I'm just out of shape. And that's like one of the things that worries me the most about myself, is that I live such a sedentary life outside of the many things that I do. But, you know, exercising, it just doesn't feel like one of those worthy investments. But it definitely is, because I'm out of breath. Obviously, talking about a story, it doesn't make any sense. Anyways, when we come back, I've seen a number 14 VIFF films, and I am going to talk about my five favorites so far and kind of an overarching theme about what I've seen, as well as if you stay tuned, there will be an interview we play for the second half between me and, yeah, Corey Pratt, who the director of Le Film Duat, who also wrote the play Le Film Duat, and is now showcasing the feature, which is premiering on October 5th. So stay tuned. You can listen to the interview. Stay tuned. You can hear me review some films. Stay tuned. You can hear me talk about some of the art and artists that have been made so far. And be right back.
Mr. Christie always wondered, when was the perfect time to enjoy a cookie? Turns out, it was any time and anywhere, except the bath. Mr. Christie tried that once, and only once.
Mr. Christie, you make good cookies.
Sometimes I look in her eyes, and that's where I find a...
So tell me.
Back right off the beam path here on 101.9 CITR.ca. Listen, if you'd like to call in, the number is 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. So we didn't get, you know, we started a little late. Didn't have enough time to talk about some of the funny stories. But a story that has come up before we kind of get into the movies is they say that they found Tupac's killer. Now, you know how I feel about this bullshit. My thought is, how long are they going to continue to milk and squeeze out of Tupac's dead body? It's kind of crazy and incredible how much news that they can do that with. Like, Tupac has been dead longer than he lived, and we are still still talking about his killers. Now, it's not that to say that, like, you know, Tupac, obviously a cultural icon, and has maintained that icon status for nearly 30 years, is incredible because he only lived to be 24. It's actually insane when you think about it. Like me as a 34-year-old, like, I think, wow, what was I doing 10 years ago? And imagining kind of that influence continuing to maintain over the next 30. And it's not even comparable. It doesn't really even make any sense. It doesn't kind of make any sense that, you know, how grown-ass people, you know, continue to, you know, be so invested. That's what I don't understand. You know, it's the investment in understanding this, because the justice that people are many are looking for are just never going to exist. It's never going to come. So I kind of wanted to start to talk about, you know, some of the fun and interesting stories that kind of came up this week. But mostly I'm just having trouble signing on to my email, which is kind of really frustrating. But a lot of stories that come out this week are not funny. They're just kind of sad. Moving on to the movies, because I don't want to depress myself before feeling something that I'm so very, very much happy about and very proud of, which is how well I think that, you know, you can do the film festival, and I don't think there's a bad way to do it, but I think there's definitely a best way to do it. And I feel like the best way to do it is to just kind of go find movies that interest you at the times that you can go. And rather than try to look at the VIFF lineup and try to find which movie do you feel like would best resonate, I feel like you should just look at the times you're available, go see which movies are playing during that time, and then just pick the one that you feel, okay, this is one that I have little familiarity with. I think that it has concepts in there that resonate with me, and I want to kind of explore the artistry and the vision for what these people put together. Because, like I said, there's so many talented people, so many people who care so much and putting so much into it, that I think that it's a great opportunity to kind of just get all the way into it, you know? And so that's what I try to do. When this past weekend, I saw three great films and a okay one. I saw The Mighty Afrin, which is a story about climate crisis in Bangladesh, which was amazing. I saw a movie called The Invention of the Other, which was a portrait of this indigenous group called the Koroburo, where some of the family was separated in a skirmish, and in the Brazilian rainforest, they have a government organization that is set up to protect the Amazon rainforest and protect the isolation of the last indigenous groups who live within the rainforest. And then I also saw a movie called The Mission, which was a portrait of that individual who in 2018 went to the North Sentinel Islands and was killed upon arrival, a missionary. And I found that, like, this weekend, between The Invention of the Other and The Mission, I was doing kind of this, I don't want to say colonialist colonization double feature, but what it looks like when you're it's very interesting. It's like what it looks like when we are telling a story about people and when we are telling a story about ourselves. And I think that for me, that was like the big highlight between and the differences between the Mighty Afrin, the Invention of the Other, and the Mission. Like the Mighty Afrin and the Invention of the Other were such beautiful telling of stories of people living in what totally different circumstances than I could ever imagine, you know, and finding filmmakers who not just understood that, but really wanted to elevate that idea that this is not a story about the viewer. This is a story about the people told from the people's perspective in situations that we in the news, we flatten. So we really flatten and make these people characters in 2D, you know, within our news and our narratives and the stories that we tell. So when we talk about climate change and we talk about the displacement of people and what that looks like in people's lives, it is so flat. We just use numbers and we don't use names and we don't talk about people and people's real experiences and what does it look like? What does it look like when climate change is making things predictably unpredictable and pushing people into different types of living situations across the globe? And what does that look like? What do their lives look like? Where does it look like? What does their day-to-day look like? And how is that impacted? And it tells this beautiful story over 5 years. This filmmaker spent over 400 days filming, you know, with people living in Bangladesh and talking and had this really beautiful portrait of this young woman who is moving and experiencing these things over her lifetime. And it was just so powerful, not just the filmmaking, not just a beautiful film, but within the storytelling, listening to the director talking about his experience there, and not just him dropping into film, but living there and talking about what are some of the challenges within filmmaking and as being a writer, producer, film editor all by himself. What did that look like? And, you know, how, what it meant for him to be able to show Afrin's story on the big screen and what it's going to mean for him, you know, as he showcases the film at Dhaka, which is the big city near a village. And it was just very interesting. I would highly recommend you to go see it. I also saw like The Invention of the Other, which was very similar. It was a very similar film, and similar in the idea that it's telling a story about people, about others, not about us. And it talks about the invention of the other, like this flattening, this idea that we have flattened what a untouched tribe looks like, right? So like, what does it mean for people who live in the bush of the rainforest, and what does their lives look like? What are they like? You know, you just close your eyes and imagine, like, what do you think that they're like? What do you think that they smile at? They laugh at? What do you think they cry about? What do you think they hug about? What do you think their interaction with each other are? And so it was such a interesting portrait. And watching the movie, not just each moment felt captivating in its own, but it pulled you into their world, not just into being this voyeur, but actually, what does that look like? What does it feel like? What do they think about? What do they talk about? You know, what do they laugh about? What do they make fun of? They refer to everybody who doesn't speak the language as white. Like, what do they refer to the white people about? You know, what do they laugh at white people about? You know, what are the customs that they find strange about? And it was just very, you know, interesting. It's the reunion between these two families and the connection that they had was something that I don't know what feelings I was anticipating watching the movie. For me, I typically go into those types of movies very skeptical. But this one was so very powerful that it kind of transcended me and brought me into this very emotive, connected state. It was very, very good. Like, I would highly suggest, it's like one of those movies I'm probably going to buy, because I find that it is, I find that it is very much connected, you know, very, it is just kind of connected on another level, which was totally different than the movie which I saw on Monday, which was The Mission. And how different The Mission is The Mission is a story about us, about this individual named John Choi, who decides at a youngish age that he's going to be the one that brings Jesus Christ to these people in the North Sentinel Islands, these people who have never asked to be touched, never asked to be protected. They've had many opportunities to contact the mainland and to be more brought into the fold of larger civilization, and, you know, and they have wholeheartedly denied and rejected these ideals. And what you see is a story about, and also one of the things is that this was also the most highly produced film, it came from National Geographic, and you could just tell that it was one of those. It's probably be on Netflix or Amazon Prime or one of those sooner than later. And it was just obviously the worst one. It just lacked this type of, it wanted you to be more empathetic around the missionaries than it did around the people who they were disrupting. And so, I mean, while it didn't shy away from those ideas that it didn't shy away from the ideas that, you know, missionary, there's a lot of issues in missionaries. However, it didn't really allow you to really connect with kind of the damage that actually happens. And so I just felt like there was so much missing in that. There was so much missing within that. And yeah, it was just my least, but it really kind of shows how much the filmmaker makes a big difference on the idea around it, how much it really, I guess it really shows the limitations around what it looks like when there's a story that's told for our consumption, and kind of reflected the story about us, but when there's opportunities for filmmakers to make films about other people that feel real, feel strong, and feel worthy of kind of, you know, feel worthy of. And it makes me feel worthy of watching. Like, I don't always feel as if like I should be allowed in, but some films can make you feel not only allowed but brought in. And so with that, I'm going to share a little story about Le Fils du Roi, which is something that an interview from Le Fils du Roi, which is something that I wasn't anticipating to be as captivating as it was to me, just in the sense of, I'm not really into musicals. I'm not into musicals that are really highlighting what first contact looks like. I think that, like I said before, like those documentaries and those movies around first contact, they're always really flattening of the, you know, of that other, that invention of the other. And what I felt like Le Fils du Roi, it just, Corey was able to kind of bring something new and something fresh. And I wanted to share, you know, I was very fortunate enough to talk with him and be able to share that with you. So after this musical break, we're going to talk a little bit about what that looked like. And I'm going to share an interview, and I just want to thank you all for being with me. Thank you.
It's hard to have patience when you're waiting on luck. Like a postal truck, like a postal truck. To bring you a love as tough as elephant tusks. No chance of rest, no chance of rest. When searching for a reason, he could only find one. He said, "You're just no fun. You're just no fun." And if seeing you naked wasn't such a bargain, it would be a home run. It would be a home run. Taken for granted. Every person that I've dated, tells me I'm intimidated. Snake that's busy praying. I wanna be as dangerous as a dancing dragon or a steam engine, a loaded gun. Be loved for my hazard and a will to destruct. And isn't that just love? A will to destruct. Isn't that just love?
So my name is Issa, and I'm
when you're
show
no fun. Isn't that just love?
So you've cried every night in your bed. So the plans worked better in your head. So the knife is your date for the night. Pill is your thrill for a while. You'll miss out. You'll never wear those clothes out. And you'll regret the parties you've painted in bed. Sorry for sure. party. Don't be sorry for missing the party. Somebody's party is missing you too.
Off the Beaten Path, and what we do is talk about some stuff that's going on in the Lower Mainland and particularly around arts and culture and kind of how the where it intersects and what does that look like. And we try to keep it serious and fun, but also really want to understand kind of the artist and how do you do what you do. And I've read a little bit about you, and you are an incredibly busy individual, so I was able to watch your film, and really looking forward to seeing it on the big screen. Just have a few questions that I wanted to ask, but I just really also really wanted to thank you and congratulate you for turning your writing into a play and then your play into film adaptation. And I think it's an amazing kind of one, probably resilience, but also just kind of being able to push things through and making some great work. So I want to thank you thank you for taking the time out to talk with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I want to tell me a little bit about yourself, and what was it that really made you want to bring this story to life?
Well, first of all, it's been something that I feel like the show has been in development for so long, first as a stage musical and now as a film. And it really was like a calling to unearth histories that hadn't been taught to me, and that were very much kind of told from one perspective. So a big part of unearthing this story has been around indigenizing it, feminizing it. We had a hard time, even when we were doing some of the early research for the show and speaking with, you know, indigenous communities from the area, a lot of, even the elders that we spoke to, their history was so influenced by like the colonial history and the colonial narrative. Mm-hmm. And they even recognized that was a struggle that they were working through even in their own community. And so I thought, well, we can actually help to serve this rebalancing, right? That we could, that the arts, like the storytelling through first the stage play and then now the film, can actually help to support the nation and the community in reviving this history and reviving a more balanced and truthful perspective on our shared history. So looking at it as not just being like the white settler perspective that came in, but what was it like for the indigenous people to see, you know, ships arrive, boats arrive, these young women to arrive, and how that, disrupted their lives. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what the film is telling. And then the way that we're telling it as well is through three languages. So through English, French, and Ganyangeha, which is a dialect of Mohawk. And that also just having the indigenous language be included as an equal in the film so that it's not solely being told through English is something that's, well, it was very challenging to do, but also very satisfying to know that even through the language, that we are rebalancing the story and the history and of what we're trying to share moving forward.
Yeah, for me, that was one of the real surprise delights of the film, was to be able to experience that within the three languages and kind of going back and forth and feeling that equal weight between not just the people, but the language. And I felt like it really added, you know, a kind of another level. And for you, when you talk about the challenges from that, what are some of the ones you encountered, but also what are some of the advantages, in making your linguistic part of the film a little bit more diverse?
Well, what was fascinating was in starting to learn Ganyangeha and we worked with an elder named Yawendas Mabel White, who's from the Akwesasne nation, and also four different language speakers and writers who specialized in the language, who helped us translate the show. And what we realized when we were doing that translation process is that there really isn't a direct translation for English into Ganyangeha, because Ganyangeha is so relational. So like the language is all tied to your relationships with each other, your relationships to the land, to history, to the future. Like it's not just so literal. It includes an entire worldview within the language. And so it wasn't like we could just directly translate one to the other. So a lot of our translation process involved storytelling on a really broad scale to understand what happened to these characters, what is their history, and then how does that inform how they relate to people, you know, that they're encountering. So that was an enormous gift to the process, that we weren't only just, well, we couldn't just translate it literally, but also through that translation process, we were able to have enormous discussions and exchanges around indigenous worldview and how that differs from, you know, the white settler colonial worldview. And so that was such a gift. And I think it's also kind of a treat for indigenous audiences, because I think when they see the film, it will really speak to what so many indigenous people are looking for nowadays, which is a connection to a history that feels familiar to us, you know? And so that was a really special thing that came from the translation process that I don't think we were prepared for.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna ask, is that something that you anticipated?
No, not at all. Like I've worked in a number of my other musicals. I've worked with language speakers in Anishinaabe, like in Anishinaabe Moan, and different dialects of Cree and things like that. But never had I worked with such a huge team, because it wasn't just like one. We worked with the experts. So we worked with an elder who provided us the sort of language teachings and the cultural knowledge around the words. But then we also worked with people who were the masters of speaking Ganyangeha, or the masters of writing Ganyangeha. So it was a really interesting balance of all these different women coming together at the Native North American Traveling College to help us really translate this piece and teach it to the cast, so that all of that was embedded in the story that we were telling.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel this adds to a wider conversation around protecting and remembering and making sure that these languages stay alive, in a sense?
Well, it's something that we learned in our development and research around the show, is that the community of Akwesasne has actually been able to maintain the number of speakers since 1992. So every time a speaker passes away, a young person picks up the language. So it isn't, you know, a dying language. It's something that's taught in schools and that's spoken regularly in the community, and they all have different dialects and different ways of saying things. So that was a really wonderful thing, and I think art can really help to serve the desires of the community in revitalizing and continuing to use their language. So really what we thought, and it was fascinating too with when we were translating, that they were actually in the community at the Native North American Traveling College were translating the script, and then some of the students in their classroom were practicing their Ganyangeha with our script. So little pieces like that, where the artistic work is actually helping and serving the community in a way that, you know, that we never had planned or anticipated, but mm-hmm. is a really wonderful gift of this project.
Mm-hmm. And so in thinking like the timing of the film's release here, particularly at VIF, is kind of during the week of Truth and Reconciliation. And, you know, how does that context kind of influence, you know, the message or the reflection that you hope that the film conveys kind of to the larger, larger audience?
It is so important that this film be seen around this time, because I think that what this film offers is a great sense of what could be and what could have been if Indigenous and non-Indigenous people had, worked together and been allies and partners in moving forward, because the piece takes place in 1665. Mm-hmm. And so this is before all of the you know, trauma and you know, painful history that Indigenous people have faced and are continuing to face. And so for me, it really is an offering to say, we have, there is a different version that this could have been. And also, we can make a new change moving forward. That the history that these characters that we're looking at, that we can still be that place that this piece is imagining. We can still operate in a way of moving forward together as equals. Because for so much of our history, and continuing to this day, that is not the case. But it takes a huge self-reflection, and also just a movement as a nation, you know, politically, around making different choices and really advocating for, you know, the rights of Indigenous people. So I think that what's great about Les Filles is that it isn't directly a piece about like truth and reconciliation, but it offers a narrative that really challenges, I think, a lot of the perspectives that are, you know, still embedded in a lot of Canadians, where there's this idea that there's only one version of the history, you know, and that there's only one version of this like colonial narrative, especially people who are looking at the history of Les Filles du Roi. And so this offers a different perspective, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like in the way that you use language and songs, particularly from all of the perspectives, it does quite a bit to kind of humanize all the parties, their agency within the larger storytelling. I want to ask a few questions about what it's like to bring a you know, a historical narrative to life through music and visuals, and what are some of the challenges adapting it from a play to kind of bringing it on the big screen?
Well, when we were starting to think of this, it really was trying to take the story that we'd told and really enhance the connection to land. And so thinking about, because in a theater, it's all imagination, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much, we're asking the audience to imagine that this stage is actually a river, you know, or imagine that it's a field in a countryside. But now through, you know, film, we're able to really give space to that in such a larger way. So it wasn't really, it wasn't a challenge. I would say the biggest challenge was trying to find spaces in the Lower Mainland that are believably, you know, Quebec. Yeah. And so that was a real challenge. And we found them out in Richmond and Delta. But, you know, it was always a challenge to sort of hide the mountains in the background, yeah, and hide, you know, these different places that we didn't really want to appear too much like Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of just a logistical thing. But what I really found was exciting was trying to meld and create a bit of a hybrid in the storytelling. So yes, celebrating the land and the place where these characters were traveling through, but also, as you probably saw in the film, there's some moments of imagination around, you know, dream space. And so for those sort of moments, we're in a theater and we're kind of having the characters operate in these spaces where the audiences are being asked to imagine and being asked to kind of project onto these characters the world that they're imagining, right, in their dream space. And so that's also a really exciting thing for me, because it takes what is so magical about the live theater experience and it asks our film audience to go with us on that journey. So it sort of holds true to what worked in the stage play, but then also allows us to expand and to incorporate land in a way for the film that I think is just so thrilling as an artist and a creator.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the transition in some of the scenes from outdoor location to black box theater, and kind of the ways that you use that technique to tell the story and to use it to kind of bring context to the characters. Can you tell me a little bit about like how you come up with that, and then also why do you feel it works so well?
Well, I think because we were, well, really the primary reason was that we wanted to be able to celebrate the power of theater and imagination and what audiences are always doing in theater spaces. So we wanted to really highlight that. But I think the best way to do that for us was in this imagined dreamlike state. So you, in the film, there's these moments where the characters either go into prayer or have a dream or have some sort of like moment of, you can see their thoughts spinning, right? And so in the film, what we did is we put those moments of dream space or of deep thought into a black box theater, mm-hmm. you know? And so we then set them up as theater spaces that sort of transitioned really seamlessly between one place to the next. Like one moment they're on a ship, the other one they're in bed, their other one they're, you know, and they're saying goodbye to their mothers and all this, you know. It's such a rich form of storytelling because it transitions so quickly between one space and the next, and that's really what works so beautifully on stage. And so now we're able to share that kind of storytelling in film. And I know that for like maybe a general or an average film goer, that might feel jarring or seem like, whoa, that's not something that we your blockbuster film will do. But for us, we feel like it really helps to challenge that standard way of filmmaking and to really look at it as an opportunity to really go on this journey with these characters and see things, these like fragmented visions and these fragmented dreams that they have in their minds, but be told through, you know, a black box theater that might not be the literal way that, you know, that we're used to seeing mm-hmm. on film.
Yeah, for me, it helped me not zero in on the film as like a period piece and more of, oh, this is a story about set in this time. This is set, you know, within the minds of the characters.
I love that.
Yeah, and
that's exactly it. You totally got it. That's exactly what we were going for. So that's thrilling to hear.
Yeah, no, great. And like music plays a central role. And you know, how do you work with your music team? How do you work with? How do you compose and, you know, really set up the songs for the film so that it can bring the characters to life